Hey, it's Andrew here, and welcome to the E-Commerce Fuel Podcast, the show dedicated to helping 7- and 8-figure brand owners build incredible businesses and amazing lives. And I, 2-3 weeks ago, told you on the show, going to start branching out into more topics that aren't specifically related to e-commerce. Still love e-commerce, still very much going to be focusing there, but I want to start talking about ancillary issues that apply to us as business owners, as entrepreneurs. And one of those that I think is very relevant and also gets me all just excited in the weirdest possible way is finance and investing. And in today's episode, I want to talk to you about how I think about personal investing and specifically some of the controversial takes that I have on it that go against kind of traditional wisdom. In particular, I want to talk about why you should buy stocks, even though everyone tells you not to, why angel investing is a terrible idea, why bonds are also a terrible idea for many people, why your retirement / financial freedom number is likely significantly less than you think, perhaps been fear-mongered, maybe not fear-mongered, but been it's lower than you think, why real estate isn't as great of an investment as it's cracked up to be, what to do instead, and also everything I have personally invested in over the last 5 years. I'm going to be naming names, prices, return rates, how it compares to indexes, all this kind of stuff. So very excited for this one. It should be a great time as long as I don't get sued by the SEC, which probably is a great time to say, this is what works for me. I am not licensed to give you any kind of financial advice. I took those licenses years ago. They've expired. Do not listen to me. Do your own research. Talk with your, you know, super smart uncle, whatever it is, or stress test these ideas. But this just works for me, and it's something I'm excited to talk about. All right, before we dive into all the geeky numbers, what's happening? Last week for our family in Bozeman right now, it has been a doozy of a week. I think I woke up the other day and it was like negative 14 degrees outside, just like butt-puckeringly cold. So as much as I love Montana, man, I'm excited to get some sunshine. The family's going to head down to Arizona here for part of our gap year, which very much looking forward to. Got to get out. The skiing has been phenomenal this year. If you are a boarder or a skier in the Northwest or just the West in general, hopefully you're getting hammered with snow as much as Montana is. So I got to get out with my dad who is, man, he's like 73, still doing really well. First time he went skiing in 20 years, which was amazing, apart from like the 5-degree temperatures. Anyway, so things are good here in the cold mountains, barely staying warm and alive. All right, let's go ahead and jump into all the numbers, all the thoughts on personal investing. All right, before I get into the specific reasons and all the data, the things I teased at the top, I want to kind of put in place three pillars and philosophical ways I approach money. The first one is I view money as freedom, not as a way to spend things. My parents were really incredible in a lot of ways, but one of those was in the way that they dealt with money and finances. I remember my mom, when we were maybe 10 or 11 years old, we would drive through the super nice part of town. And we lived in a great house, fine house, but it was, you know, very kind of middle class, 2,000 square feet in your just an average neighborhood. And we would drive through the super nice part of town, and my mom was always good about talking about money candidly. And she said, hey, you know, kids, we could live here, but if we did that, we wouldn't be able to save as much money. We wouldn't be able to put money towards your college fund. And it wasn't something that really hit home until, you know, I graduated from high school and my parents were able to you know, help contribute at least half of my college education, which was a huge gift. And even cooler, my parents at age, when my dad was probably 52, he had a very high stress job at this nuclear reactor facility. And he got to the point where he walked in one day and just handed in his resignation and just blew the minds of people there. And they say, how do you do this? I would love to do this. How can you afford to do this? And the answer was that he and my mom had been planning for this for 2 decades. And they went on to have a really interesting career where they went to run a homeless shelter. He ended up being a pastor in Alaska. He did all of these cool things that he found more meaningful because he'd been intentional. So anyway, that was the framework I came up with. So I look at all of this from the framework of how can you use money and finances investing to create a financial flywheel for yourself that doesn't let you just retire on a beach, but gives you the freedom to work on what you want to. The second thing is, as a framework, as I think is really important to stress, is you've got to know your personal numbers, especially around burn. There's one of my favorite sayings is you're wealthy if the amount of passive income you generate is more than your expenses than you have as a family or an individual. And you would never think of not knowing how much you're spending, how much you're bringing in, how much you're making in your business. But so many of us don't know that for our personal life. And it doesn't have to be perfect, but you need some framework in place for this. Even if it's as simple as, hey, what is my credit card bill? Like, this is one thing Andy and I do. We just put everything on a single credit card and we look at that amount every month. And that's not perfect, but it's within 95% of what our burn is. So we have a really good sense about that. And then finally, I strongly believe you should always be building your personal balance sheet alongside your business enterprise value. And this is something that actually was articulated very clearly by Roman Kahn at one of our ECF lives. And he made the case where you don't know what's going to happen with an exit. You don't know if you're going to sell your business for a lot of money. And not only does investing outside of your business help mitigate risk, help you become a better investor, help you practice flexing that muscle. So if you do ever sell for a lot of money, you have the ability to manage a big lump of cash because that doesn't just come overnight. Like anything else, it's a skill you have to build. But it helps you be more scrappy with your business. It helps you make those dollars go further because the more money you have in your business, the more likely you are to spend it suboptimally. So there are exceptions here. If you are growing hand over fist and you can buy inventory and you know you're going to be able to sell it at 2, 3x, 4x what you pay for it, there's exceptions here. But in general, I think building your own personal balance sheet alongside the value of your business is a really wise idea. All right, let's get into the actual numbers and things here. And I am a bettor. I love to bet. All of the stuff we're going to talk about here is about maximizing your expected value returns. So there's going to be volatility, of course. Favorite book, The Psychology of Money. I think Morgan Housel says, volatility is the price that you pay for return. And so none of these things are guaranteed. Again, see disclaimer at the top. But if you like betting and playing the odds, this is how I like to think about personal investing. All right, number one, you should buy individual stocks. But a huge caveat here. So many people say you should not do this. And in general, I think that they are right. But I think if you, A, have a really high degree of conviction about a stock in an area you have an unfair advantage in, and B, you don't put much of your portfolio into it, let's say 10% of less, I think it can be a really wise decision. And to back that up with data, I want to walk you through, I only own 4 stocks. And so I'm going to walk you through over the last 5 years, the stocks that I have purchased and how they have done relative to the benchmark. So first stock, Shopify, not a shocker here. I'm guessing you would have bet on this. Purchased that in kind of middle of 2022. And it has since then returned on average every year, 47%. So that doesn't mean it's up 47% since then. It means every year the compounding on it is 47%. The NASDAQ has returned about 19% since then. Why did I buy it? Pretty obvious. If you're listening, you probably know. Phenomenal company. It had fallen off a cliff. It got just beaten down and it was a good buy. Cloudflare, its ticker is NET. Bought that in late 2019. Since then, the annual return on that every year has been about 50%, whereas the NASDAQ has compounded about 36%. And why did I buy that? I bought it because we used Cloudflare in the business. I liked it. I thought their DNS was really easy to use, intuitive. We had some customer experience and support issues with them. I was very impressed. And I just thought their software worked really well. So picked them up when they IPO'd. Third one, Tesla, bought them in the middle of 2020. They since then have returned about 32% per year. And the NASDAQ has returned about 15% per year over that same period. Got to give a shout out to Michael Jacksonis for this one. He had a Tesla, was madly in love with it, and convinced me that it was an interesting play. Also had another advisor and mentor who also saw Tesla, not even from an electric vehicle perspective, but from just all the other potential, you know, the batteries, the electrical infrastructure. He was looking really far down the road and was a huge fan of that. And then finally, Airbnb picked it up recently, just this fall. And it, over that time, has, again, this is a, take this with a very big grain of salt, it's got a 90% IRR over only 3 or 4 months when the NASDAQ has returned, you know, about 27%. Again, a lot of noise in that one. But point being, I've only bought 4 stocks over the last 5 years. For each one of them, felt like I had a high degree of conviction. They were something that I felt like I used, I loved, the kind of things that not a lot of people would maybe have a lot of insights into, particularly with Shopify and Cloudflare. And so, you know, you look at the average returns there, you know, you're getting probably on average anywhere from 32% to, you're outperforming the indexes by, on the low end, 37%, on the high end, a 3 or a 4x, you know, 3x. So I think this makes a lot of sense. The other thing too is it helps you develop an investing intuition. These make up probably only, you know, less than 10% of my portfolio. And you might ask, like, why wouldn't you put more into these if you're outperforming? And I think the reasons are, one, A, risk mitigation. This might not always work in the future. And two, you really have to learn to trust yourself, because there's so many times I've had so many misses over the last 10 years. And I think to get the courage to start investing, you need to start seeing opportunities that you felt good about, missing them, and in the rearview mirror being like, I should have trusted my gut here. For example, like Reddit, I really wanted to invest in them, didn't do it. It's done phenomenally since the IPO. Shopify at the IPO, I was working with them a ton back when we started e-commerce fuel, and I had the chance to buy them like right out of the gates, did not. Holding on to our first house as a rental, I made the argument, I know this is going to be a great piece of property because of X, Y, and Z reasons, didn't do it. And the rental property is 4x'd since then in value. Anyway, so all that said, I think buying individual stocks can give you a really nice small section of alpha, which is just kind of investor geek code for return above the average. If you do it incredibly sparingly, you hold it, you're disciplined with not letting it get too big. Hey, Andrew here with a brief intermission to introduce you to Chris Kresser, the founder of AdaptNaturals.com. And I admire Chris for a couple of reasons. One, he's a globally renowned expert in the functional medicine space. And secondly, he's built this business, AdaptNaturals, completely on his own terms. He used to have a much bigger business, shrunk it down so he had more time, energy, and flexibility to spend time outside with his family. Very, very cool entrepreneur. And he's been a member of e-commerce fuel for a couple of years now. And here's what he has to say about the experience.
Early on, I joined ECF, which I have to say was a huge, like a very great decision, one of the best decisions I made. And because I knew intuitively that like there's a universe of people out there who are way ahead of me in terms of, you know, who've already figured this out, and or at least are further down the path of figuring this out, and they've already experienced and in many cases overcome a lot of the challenges and problems that I know I will be facing as I walk down this road. And I don't need to reinvent the wheel here. And I love the community you've built with ECF Live. I know firsthand how much work goes into building a community, and one especially that where people, there's so much mutual respect and just a real ethic of people helping each other out and being like, you know, rising tide lifts all boats. And I really feel that in ECF Live. And I think that starts from the top. So kudos to you for doing that. And it's been an enormous help for me. And like I said, it exposed me to so many people that I've become good friends with and have become colleagues and have helped AdaptNaturals to thrive. So thank you for that.
After hearing literally hundreds of comments like this over the last decade our community's been around, it's easy to offer our 10x guarantee. If you don't get at least a 10x ROI on your membership in the first year, in terms of increased revenue, saved time, and saved money, we'll give you a full refund plus an extra $1,000. But many of our members report seeing massive value in just the first month or two when applying it to their 7 or 8 figure business. You can learn more about the community and apply for membership at ecommercefuel.com. Okay, back to the show. Number two, don't angel invest. I feel like angel investing is this thing that it's very tempting for people to do if you've had a little bit of success in the online world, you've built a little bit of a network, you feel like it is this, it's this avenue where you can go and get above average returns. And this isn't something, I've done a handful of angel investments, only a handful, and I'll name them again because I said I was going to say everything I've invested in specifically in the last 5 years. I've invested in IntelliGems, their pricing tool for e-commerce, CanPie Foods, which is a candy company, and Postpilot, which I'm sure many people are familiar with. They do direct mail marketing. And from angel investments, that's really it. And I'm very happy with all three of those investments. I've probably, again, not doing it, haven't done it for a while. For everyone that I invested in, you know, turned down 15 or 20 or 25. And this was when I was right in the middle of running ECF Capital. But I think angel investing is one of those things where it sounds sexy to do. It sounds, you know, it sounds great to be able to put like, I'm an investor on your LinkedIn profile or your Twitter profile. But from talking to a lot of people, And again, this is not a reflection on any of those companies. I'm very happy with all three of these. But in talking to a lot of people, they genuinely don't work out. I've talked to people who have made 50 angel investments and none of them have cashed out. And even if they do cash out and you have a liquidity event, you're holding on to these often for 3, 4, 5, 10 years sometimes. Your money is tied up for a long time. I remember when I was raising money for our ECF capital investments, it was a syndicate model, so we were getting soft commits. But I ended up talking with an investing mentor, the same person who recommended Tesla. And he kind of sat me down and he said, you know, I know it looks sexy to be able to invest in these private companies, but I've done this a lot. And the thing is, your money is tied up for 5 to 10 years a lot of times. You have to really know what you're doing. Whereas in the public markets, you can get in, you can get out, which can also be a bad thing. Anyway, bottom line, angel investing looks great, looks like this land of great returns. I think it's exponentially harder than people think. Number three, if you are under 50 years old, and maybe even if you're over 50, bonds are almost certainly costing you a lot of money. I own less than 1% of my portfolio in bonds. And if I could sell those without any kind of tax issues, I would liquidate them tomorrow. I have a big argument with my brother about bonds and about whether or not they have a place in a portfolio. And he's a PhD in economics. So again, like I said, do your own research here. But here's my thesis for this. Why do people push them? Why do people advocate for them? And to be fair, they are advocated more for people who are closer to retirement or older, hence the 50 plus cohort. But bonds let you hedge against downside risk, not always, but often in a market downturn, they're going to hold more of their value or maybe even sometimes go up as people buy into what are considered safer assets versus stocks, which get tanks. They let you rebalance. It's kind of like a way of holding cash with more return. So again, if you're in a market period of market volatility, stocks go down, your bonds stay buoyant, you can take some of that money and reinvest in stocks at lower prices, which will help your returns. And they're great if you just want less volatility. Some people really cannot deal with seeing their portfolio down 20%, 25%, 30%. It's hard for everyone. Some of us are better at dealing with that than others. But my argument is, if you have a 10 to 20 year horizon for the money that you're investing, or if you have a significant amount of money that, you know, if you lost a big chunk of it, you would still be fine and you are just optimizing for maximum returns and you can deal with the volatility. If you look at the S&P 500, the real returns over since about 1925, based on calculations I've done, are about 6.6%. So that's returns after inflation. Corporate bonds, which are going to be bonds that are going to probably give you the best yield over treasuries, they average in real returns after inflation about 2.9%. So the S&P is more than doubling the amount that you're getting over that time period. But you might say like, hey, Andrew, again, volatility, what happens if you happen to time it wrong, which is a fair question. But again, I also looked at the time periods since 1925, and I think I got chopped up every 10-year periods every 5 years. And stocks outperformed bonds in 79% of the 10-year periods since 1925. So bottom line here, if you are willing to deal with the volatility, if you can have the stomach to hold on, and if you have the time horizon or the wealth already, you are paying a massive, massive premium in terms of an opportunity cost to invest in bonds. And again, if you're older, if preservation of capital and sleeping well at night is really important to you, fantastic. Bonds probably have a place. But something I think that people don't think enough about, and they just put a big chunk, 20, 30, 40% in their portfolio and don't realize they're giving up a ton of return because of it. All right, next one. The 4% rule, I think, is wildly conservative. So if you're not familiar with this, I talked at the top about knowing your burn rate. And why is that important? Well, that tells you how much of your nut you want to cover. And again, it's not so we can go sip pina coladas on the beach and try to go play ultimate frisbee 20 years past our prime on college campuses in retirement. Like it's so that we can work on what we want to work on, make decisions without money being the primary catalyst for driving what we do, how we spend our time. And so there's this idea that if you take, let's say you have $1 million and you apply the 4% rule, you should be able to, at least over a fairly long period of time, 30 plus years, be able to withdraw 4% per year, so $40,000, increased annually, adjusted annually for inflation, and have a very high degree of confidence about not running out of money. That's great, Here's the problem, I think, with that. If you're trying to think through, okay, where am I on this spectrum financially? First, one, it assumes you're never going to work again in your life, which I think for a lot of entrepreneurs building wealth, they want to keep doing things. It's just they want to maybe change the things that they're doing, or they want to have the freedom to have, again, money not be the primary driver. It assumes you'll never drop your spending. One of the assumptions in this 4% rule is that if the market takes a massive dip right when you invest all your money, that you're going to keep spending at the same rate. So it assumes no flexibility in your spending given market conditions. It's got a very high degree of confidence, like 90% confidence interval. I believe it also assumes a 60-40 stock bond split, which we just talked about earlier, why I think that's probably a poor, perhaps not the best strategy. And the final thing is it doesn't factor in that money that you spend earlier in your life is more valuable than money later. Again, you've probably heard about this, but Die with Zero is a fantastic book. It changed how I thought about investing and spending on experiences. And a lot of times, especially for people, if you're listening to this, if you're ambitious, if you're working and building wealth through a business, almost there's a very high degree of likelihood that you're going to have enough money in the long run. And spending it now when you're able-bodied, when you have the ability to enjoy it, it's probably worth 2, 3, 4x than when you're 80 years old. So I like, when I look at this, I like the 4.5 to 5% rule much better. And again, play with this, experiment, get into a wine-fueled hour and a half discussion with ChatGPT about it. But you are not going to have as much of a degree of certainty that your money is going to last. But if you could, imagine I came to you and I said, hey, you have two scenarios. You can either have scenario A, where you start making decisions from a place of agency and non-financial implications, and you can do what you want, run your business how you want, spend your time how you want 10 years earlier, and you have only an 80% chance of your money lasting, or you have to work an extra 10 years, but you have a 90% chance of your money lasting. To me, again, I'm kind of a betting man, but that 10 years for an extra 10% degree of certainty, I don't like that trade-off. I think it's a bad trade-off. So anyway, 4% rule, I think, is wildly conservative. And I think it makes sense to think more about the 4.5 to 5. Real estate. Obviously, a lot of people talk about real estate. I think real estate is overrated as an investment. I think it's a nice diversifier. It is nice to be able to put money into something, a hard asset, something that, yes, it can be volatile, but all things equal, people are going to need places to live. It's not a security. It's a nice diversifier, but I think your returns on average are probably going to be worse than stocks. And it's not liquid. If you ever want to sell a piece of property, it's an enormous amount of work sometimes to sell them and get them ready. It's a lot of work. And so thinking through this, granted, huge disclaimer, this is just one point in time. And you could probably come with a lot of counterexamples to this. But let's look at, we purchased a home in Bozeman, Montana in 2015. You could probably find a couple other places where homes and real estate have done better, but Montana from 2015, especially from 2020 onward, probably did in terms of appreciation, was some of the best performing real estate in the whole country. And so if you look at that, I compared the purchase price and we bought it 2015, it effectively doubled between 2015 and today, we still have it. And so if you look at that, the IRR on that, just from a pure appreciation point, is 7.8%. That doesn't include the amount you could make from the rental income. So let's say the cap rates in Bozeman are about 3%. Cap rate is the return you get when you're renting it out, less all of your expenses. So let's say on average, you're looking at kind of a rudimentary 11%. Well, the NASDAQ or the S&P over that same time returned about 12.5%. And I remember also running a analysis on this when we were thinking about either should we keep it, should we sell it, when we moved, and we decided to keep it, and it was pretty close to even with stocks. The big side again with having your money in stocks versus real estate is it's liquid. If you want to sell it, you press a button and it's done versus a massive amount of work to offload real estate. So I think real estate's fantastic as a diversifier. It's also fantastic if you can somehow get some kind of personal benefit from it. So for example, we would use it as a place to come and visit in Bozeman for some of the year. And when we looked at the rental rates that we would have to pay on the market versus what we could use our house for, it made the returns significantly more attractive, but only because we were using it. And you got to be careful that you do it by the book here because there's some real specific tax laws and things that you need to follow, which we did. All that to say, real estate's, I think if you are a commercial real estate tycoon who is someone who is a real estate professional and you can offset ordinary income with the depreciation from your real estate, and this is your jam, awesome. You can probably do this well. If you are running a business and just are thinking about having a handful of rental properties and that's going to be how you want to have a side hustle, I'm not saying don't do it, but I'm saying that stocks probably have, apart from diversification, just as much return potential as the investment portfolio. All right. So talked about a lot of things here. I talked about a lot of things not to do. So what do you do for the rest of investing apart from buying stocks? And of course, I think it goes without saying, investing in your own business is going to give you the highest rate of return here in most cases. But outside of those things, it's pretty boring. When I look at the vast majority of my portfolio, it is in low-cost index funds. Again, not going to spend a lot of time here because most of you know it, but I've got about 80% every month that I have just an automated rule that dumps into a US total, what do I have? It's a total stock market index through Vanguard. It's a little broader than the S&P 500, so it gets, you know, kind of those big companies, it gets some smaller growth ones. That's about 80%, and then about 20% into international stocks. If you look at the S&P 500, about half of the exposure there is already international, so you get a big chunk there. But if you look at, you know, I'm recording this, happy Valentine's Day, by the way, on Valentine's Day 2025. This should make for, this will come out later, but it's not exactly your most romantic banter. So it's a good thing this is coming out a week later. But if you look at valuations right now, the US market is trading at a significant premium on a earnings basis, on like a valuation basis, than international markets. And so it's probably going to correct at some point. Anyway, 80-20 US to international. I just have a recurring dollar cost average, and that's where most of my portfolio is. So in summary, this isn't business related. This is just purely personal. Things that work for me, I always know my burn rate. I'm trying to build up my personal balance sheet alongside the value and the equity, the enterprise value of my business. I buy stocks on a highly, highly selective basis when I feel a high degree of conviction. In general, steer clear of angel investing. I have, for the most part, zero exposure to bonds. When I look at thinking through financial, the generation of passive income, I look at, like, I stretch that 4% rule to maybe 4.5 to 5. I'm very eyes wide open with real estate in terms of how good of an investment it is relative to the other options, especially the stock market, and just dollar cost average with the rest of my funds. So I'd love to hear what you think about this. There's a lot of smart, financially savvy people. And I probably made a handful of them drive off the road at various points along this, where things I didn't think about, and I'm open to changing my opinion on all these things with good data, with good insight. So let me know, where am I wrong? If you have questions on any of this, questions on finance, investing, I'd love to answer them along with Bill D'Alessandro, who is another sharp financial mind, on our State of Play monthly episode. Or if there's anything else you'd like me to talk about, one thing I'm thinking about doing is doing an annual review of my entire portfolio. So every year in and out, kind of like I did today for the things I've invested in for the last 5 years, talking about that on an annual basis, how the investment portfolio did, what I left in there, new things I bought, things I sold, et cetera. So if you'd like to hear that, if you have questions, if you want to completely shoot me down and tell me why I'm making awful decisions, podcast@ecommercefuel.com. Would love to hear your thoughts, and thanks so much for listening. Forge what matters. My grandpa was a pretty incredible guy. He was born in rural Montana, and over the years, he built up a construction business. That's actually still around today, run by my cousin, third generation, Udarian Construction. He was an incredible man, incredibly hardworking, a big guy, tall, probably 6'2" or 6'3", and very jovial. Always had a smile on his face, always had a hat. I know trucker's hats came into fashion. He was the original OG trucker hat guy and would always be sitting just tilted at about 15 degrees on his head. Could talk with just about anyone. And it was just a jovial fun. But it was contrasted with a side of him that took work seriously. And I remember one time when I was probably, I don't know, maybe 8 or 9 years old, I was out sweeping his driveway because he had asked me to do that. And I came back in. And he looked at me because it hadn't been very long. And he said, "Are you sure you swept that well?" And we walked back out and he quickly dissuaded me of any notions that I had done a good job. He showed me all of the places where it was not swept well. He taught me how to sweep with a broom so it didn't leave a lot of residue. And he was not doing it gently for an 8-year-old. He was using the sharp side of his personality and of his words to let me know that this was a completely unacceptable job and it was not up to snuff. I remember two things about our next door neighbors when I was growing up in Idaho. We lived on this unassuming street, and the Gallups lived next door. They were elderly neighbors. I don't know, maybe in their 70s or maybe even early 80s. And the first thing was that, at least for a 5-year-old boy, they had the absolute most incredible place to pee. And if you've got little boys, you're familiar, because they just go anywhere under the age of maybe 5 or 6. And the Gallups had this hole on the outside of their fireplace, hidden by bushes, close to where we often played. And it was perfect because it was such a long trek to the bathroom. We didn't want to stop playing. And it was perfect. And we didn't connect until probably 10 years later that the horrors we inflicted upon their living room and the conversations that probably went on about this mysterious issue. I apologize, Gallups. I never got to tell you that in person, and unfortunately, it's too late. But that was the first thing. The second thing I always remember about the Gallups was that we always shoveled their walk in the winter. And they lived on the corner, and they had a really big walk. And given they were old, my parents would make myself and my brother shovel their walk. And especially in the early days, we would go out and we'd get it shoveled. We'd get most of the snow off, but there'd still be those lines. There'd still be kind of the sloughs. It would be kind of a 70, 80% job. It looked like crap. And my dad would always bring me back out and have me clean it up and make it look nice and do a good quality job. And I hated it. I thought he was being ridiculous and stupid, but he always made me do it. And finally, I got to the point where I realized it was going to be more work if I didn't. So I did it. My first job out of college, in investment banking, the guy who was right above me was a terrible teacher in almost every sense of the word. Stoic, quiet, a man of few words, hated mentoring, but he was incredible at making me care about little details. He would have spreadsheets he'd send over to me, and he'd come back and he'd make me reformat them with the perfect size font. We only used Times New Roman. We only did everything in 12. We only used this exact shade of purple. If you got the wrong shade of purple, no, it was wrong. Go back and do it again. And I thought he was such an anal, inefficient guy, until the next person came in a year after me and all their spreadsheets looked like a disaster. As a parent, as a company leader, one of your biggest jobs is to set a really good standard, not just to set the standard. And I think the hardest thing here, the first priority, is how does your work look? Because if the work you're doing is crappy, if it's not good, no one else is going to respect you when you ask them to do better. And so this is the biggest challenge for me. I'm guessing it's the biggest challenge for you. It's hard to do well, especially with a lot of competing priorities. Assuming you can get that most difficult thing out of the way, your second job is to lovingly and tactfully expect a lot out of others. Culture is what you tolerate. That's not something I said. I'm stealing that from someone else, but I love that quote. We had a huge design project this fall with a contractor that we spent a lot of money with. And the first round of options that we got back were not great. And I had to push back, tell this team, who was convinced their work was really good, to go back to the drawing board. I felt like a high maintenance client, which I hate. It hurt our relationship, which I wasn't excited about. And it was 100% the right thing to do. The work we ended up getting back was probably 2x to 3x better than it was the first time. With my kids, I make them go back outside, just like my dad, and clean up the lines on the walk when they do a bad job shoveling. Even if it's 10 degrees, even if I don't want to fight with them because I just got home from work and I just want to relax and it'd be more work for me to go out and do it or ignore it, it's super important to do. I think holding and setting the quality standard gracefully, modeling it well, albeit imperfectly, is one of the greatest gifts that you can give to those you've been entrusted to lead, even and especially if it's not always immediately appreciated. If you're an entrepreneur who wants to connect with other experienced owners who are working to build a financially vibrant business alongside a rich, meaningful life, head on over to ecommercefuel.com to learn more and connect with 1,000 entrepreneurs just like you. Work hard, adventure often, and forge what matters. Look forward to seeing you again next Friday.